Let's do that. That sounds like a good idea. All right, well, let's go ahead and get started this evening. We've got some ground to cover, and it's important stuff. I sure hope you guys had a good Christmas and New Year, and happy early Epiphany tomorrow. It's an important part of it. So today's the 11th day of Christmas. Tomorrow is the 12th, and then we get to have Epiphanies. It's a celebration of when the Magi finally showed up in Bethlehem after they spent like 2 years traveling. So, lazy guys. Going so slow. All right, so tonight we get to start what I call, and a lot of people do call, the Imperial Church. And so you will notice a marked difference between what we have been studying and what we are going into. You're going to get things that are much more official. You're going to get politics all intertwined with theology. You're going to get emperors that are now taking sides in theological debates. Bishops that are close with local rulers. Bishops that are enemies of local rulers. And you're going to have such a different tone to the next several hundred years, at least to the fall of Rome. So when that finally all crumbles and the only thing remaining is the East, out in the West, we're left with not much. So all of that starts with a man named Constantine, and we've discussed him to a little bit of an extent. I gave you kind of a primer before we went on break and kind of introduced how he established a lot of his power in the West, in Gaul, and in what, you know, Iberia and Frankish areas there, and then was able to quickly come and take over certain things that are important aspects of the empire, especially Rome itself. And as he established a lot of his control, when he got to a certain point, he was okay with a joint system between him and Licinius, and they held that for about 8 or 9 years to try to stem off any concept of civil war. But there was two different ways that these guys interacted, most importantly, with the religions in the culture. And that really ended up making a huge difference. And we're going to kind of walk through some of that tonight. And then all of a sudden, we find ourselves at the first ecumenical council of the church, but a couple years later, which is just mind-blowing. There's such a whiplash of feeling in the church, because in 311 you have, as we mentioned, the Edict of Galerius, the Edict of Toleration, where he ends his persecution of the Christians. That's in 311. It's not 14 years later they're all standing in Nicaea with the next emperor, who's actually presiding over the council in Nicaea, as they're coming to solve some of the problems of the Eastern Church, namely Arius and the Arian controversy that was taking hold in Alexandria. So what do we do with all of this? Because the early church, as it came, and I titled 2 weeks ago, The Last Generation of the Early Church. It sounds really like climactic, right? The reality is that last generation didn't like just die there. They're here and having to deal with this dramatic shift. In fact, the largest shift that's ever occurred. That includes the Protestant Reformation. It is the largest shift that ever took place in church history, and they're trying to wrap their heads around how is it we interact with such things. In fact, most textbooks, as they're walking through, when they get to the year 300, they'll stop, and they'll go topical for several chapters to try to address all the things that have just changed, from different reactions in theology to different reactions in the monastic reforms to different reactions and separations between theologians, those who were hired court theologians, those who saw that as kowtowing to the officials and, you know, signing agreements with the beast or whatever. There's all sorts of different things that go on. So a lot of splits happen, a lot of frustrations happen. And so we're not going to stop and deal with all of that. We're going to deal with it as we go through, which just means that our walking through of the 300s is going to go a little bit slower. The Imperial Church really does only last for a couple hundred years, and then we'll get into the medieval church, and some of the awesome parts of that, because it's not the Dark Ages. It's actually a pretty awesome period of history, and a pretty sad one for the Western Church. And so we'll be dealing with some of the Eastern Church, the expansion of Islam, and a lot of that kind of as we come to the summertime. But until then, we're going to be spending some time with the Imperial Church. So get to know some big names, get to know some of these people, these movers and shakers of what's going on, because we're going to be spending, sometimes when someone like Augustine shows up, or sometimes when someone like Jerome shows up, we're going to spend a whole evening just talking about that person. And so that'll slow us down a little bit, obviously. So, all right, any questions before we even get started here tonight with regards to setting or expectation? Or did you go back and spend all of Christmas reading about Constantine and you got some ideas? I didn't do that. Okay, stop me if ever there comes something up. Let's go to 313. After the taking over at the Milvian Bridge and the setting aside of Maxentius's rule, all of a sudden we have Constantine in charge of Rome. He, depending on which historical source you read, he either had a vision or a dream where Christ or a voice told him to conquer in this name, and or he sees the Cairo signal, which looks like an X and a P over it. It's just shorthanded abbreviation in Greek for Christ. You know, go and conquer in this name. Whatever actually happened, the effect of it was that he put such things on his flags and on his standards and on his shields. And one of the great things about Constantine was he was a remarkable planner when it came militarily speaking. Whatever he set out to do, he did well. He covered his flanks, he covered his sides. Even when he came to take over all of this stuff, he only brought a quarter of his army because he knew it was a surprise attack, and he didn't want to allow a roundabout again, which is one of the ways that these civil wars kept changing hands left and right. It didn't matter who was in charge. If you were taking over one guy, remember there was four rulers at the time in the Tetrarchy. If you're taking over one guy, the other guy would just take advantage of it. And so he waited until one was distracted fighting a battle against the Germanic tribes in the north on the Danube. And he goes, boom, I can take Rome in a day. And he did. And the reality is, the effect of this, and the effect of the story of this, and this vision that he had before this, or the supposed vision, or however that worked, the effect of it is that when you saw these flags, when you saw these shields, whatever magical thing happened that allowed him to take over Rome, you now have no hope. What does that do for other Romans who follow other generals when you're facing that on the battlefield? True or not, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. The legend actually kind of goes ahead of the thing. And if you're a Christian, which makes up a good 10% of the empire at this point, that's a pretty interesting story to keep handing down the way. And things like that spread in the military pretty quick as well. Look how simple this happened. It basically just, the doors opened to us in front of us. It happens all the time. It always affects the military concept of itself in history. We ran into it even when we came into, when Europeans came to this land. All of a sudden, all the natives die in front of us. And we have this huge, no germ theory, we didn't know it was smallpox that was getting everyone. We didn't know what was happening. All we knew is it seemed that God was just killing everyone in front of us and just gifted us an entire continent. We went from a place that was populated with 90 million Native Americans to 9 million left. No cities left, no anything left. 90% of them died in one generation. What does that do to theology? We'll talk about that when we get to that, because they're leaving all of the wars that are going on, these theological wars over in Europe, and coming over here, and boom, God just gifted you a brand new continent.
Oh, you can take back historically, too, to the Exodus.
Absolutely. A promised land that's flowing with all this stuff. And God's going to take care of your enemies in front of you. That same kind of concept plays into the time period of Constantine as well. And so you'll run into stories where he'll come somewhere and people just don't want to fight him. Which, if you're going to try to bring an empire together under a singular rule, that's really handy. And he was patient enough to let those rumors percolate for several years before he actually went and challenges Licinius. So before that, we get one of the first things that Constantine does when he comes in power in the entire Western part of the, empire. And that is the Edict of Milan. Now, a lot of people, when they're first studying church history, will run into the Edict of Milan and go, boom, there, that's where Constantine made Christianity the state religion. It's not where he made Christianity the state religion. That happens much later on. The Edict of Milan doesn't even outlaw persecution. That was the Edict of Toleration in 311. That was Galerius ending his persecution. There was no persecution going on. The Edict of Milan cemented that. The new regime is going to support that. And most importantly, all the property we took from the Christians gets back to them. The church buildings we took from them goes back to them. Even if they're forced to give it away, we have to give it back to them. And so it's an interesting thing. It's not a very long text, but it's a good one to read and kind of get your mind around the tone of it. I did want to read you just the first half, which is only one paragraph of it, so that you can kind of get an idea for the tone of it. Right? So here it is. Edict of Milan. First, like, third of it. When I, Constantine Augustus, remember, Augustus the higher of the ones, as well as I, Licinius Augustus, did formerly meet in Milan and were considering everything that pertained to the public welfare and security. We thought, among other things, which we saw would be good for many, those regulations pertaining to the reverence of the divinity ought certainly to be made first, so that we might grant to the Christians and others full authority to observe their religion which each preferred. Whence any divinity whatsoever in the seat of the heavens might be propitious and kindly disposed to us and all who are placed under our rule. And thus, by this wholesome counsel and most upright provision, we thought to arrange that no one whatsoever should be denied the opportunity to give his heart to the observance of the Christian religion, of that religion which he should think best for himself, so that the supreme deity, to whose worship we freely yield our hearts, may show in all things his usual favor and benevolence. Therefore, your worship should know that it has pleased us to remove all conditions whatsoever which were in the rescripts formerly given to you officially concerning the Christians, and now any one of those who wishes to observe Christian religion may do so freely and openly without molestation. We thought it fit to commend these things most fully to your care, that you may know that we have given to these Christians free and unrestricted opportunity of religious worship. When you see that this has been granted to them by us, your worship will know that we have also conceded to other religions the right to open and free observance of their worship for the sake of peace in our times. Look what they're aiming for. We don't want any more civil wars. Peace in our times. That each one may have the free opportunity to worship as he pleases. This regulation is made that we may not seem to detract from any dignity or any religion. Moreover, in the case of the Christians especially, we esteemed it best to order that if it happens that anyone heretofore has brought from our treasury for anyone whatsoever, those places where they were previously accustomed to assemble, this is their church buildings, such as they were at the beginning of the 4th century, concerning which a certain decree had been made, the letter sent you officially, the same shall be restored to the Christians without payment or any claim of recompense and without any kind of fraud or deception, etc., etc., and he gives all the details. Give their buildings back to them. Give them their freedom. And by the way, did you notice it extends to all religions? This is a brand new thing, right? Before this, the only way to hold together an empire was to establish a singular worldview that we will defend, period. That's always been the way of it. And this is one of the very first times in history where we actually see, you know what? Everyone can just worship as they see fit. That's unique. Quite unique, especially for the ancient world. And you will see a certain toleration of this that is odd for Rome. Now, Rome itself as an empire is not set up to handle this. And so while the emperor is saying this, remember, there's two Augustuses at this point. While Constantine and Licinius are both saying this, Licinius has no love lost between him and Christians. He's not like in support of them. He's not claiming to be one. Constantine is claiming to be one. Licinius knows he has no military hope against Constantine. This is why he's planning his assassination here in a little bit. Give that little piece away. He's trying to figure out a way around, trying to figure out this. Constantine, how many opinions are there about whether or not he's actually a Christian at this point? There's 1,000 opinions about what it is. What can be said with clarity is the man knows the value of aligning himself with this. Now, here's why. It's not because there's a lot of Christians. It's not. Because there really weren't that many. And as we discussed before, there were hardly any in the military. Because most Christians were against military service at all of any kind. And so this wasn't like gaining him military favors. But he saw that what happened at the Milvian Bridge continued to affect his influence throughout the empire. Whether he saw Christ as the supreme God or as the unconquered son or like the god over all the Roman gods or whatever the case may be, it's almost impossible to reconstruct his theology because unfortunately most of the histories we have about him, we'll get into this, are hagiographical. It means embellished by people who really like him, people like Eusebius of Caesarea, who was the first church historian who worked in his court. You'll search forever and a day to find someone who likes the taste of the emperor's boots more than Eusebius, unfortunately. And he's also singularly a source for almost any of this stuff. And that goes for a number of theologians, people like Lactantius and others who are actually in the court itself. Very, very, very hard to figure out what Constantine's actual theology is. But he saw the value, both militarily and culturally, and most importantly, not just of toleration to the Christians, but of everyone.
Does he claim any special status in his theology?
Yes. Yes, especially at the end of his life. We'll get into that. Yes, he does. And that doesn't start off that way. And again, this is why it's so confusing. Because there's all sorts of... there's all sorts of developments. And his life doesn't continue on very long either. And which makes it even more confusing. Because he doesn't get to re-clarify throughout his life. Or clarify at all, honestly. And so we'll get into that for sure. But Constantine himself, interesting guy. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about him here. We discuss him not because he is part of the church or because we're making that call that he's a Christian and therefore he's someone worth studying. We're studying him because the effect that he had on the church is greater than any other singular person. That includes people like Martin Luther on the Western Church and Augustine for theology and the intersection of theology and philosophy. That includes even Thomas Aquinas, I would put out. Because the approach of the church to the culture in which it lives was defined by both East and West by interactions with Constantine in this short, like, 20-year reign. It's remarkable how much it affected, and it's why we pay attention to him. It's not because I'm sitting here going, yay, the first Christian emperor, that's marvelous, let's just pay attention to him. No, the effects of what he did, both in establishing Constantinople, establishing general tolerance for all these things, establishing things like tax exempt status, supporting, not just supporting, but paying for theological undertakings, the building of churches. I mean, the reality is, medieval churches look like Roman basilicas for a reason. It's because of Constantine. Yes, sir? So, depends on where you are. Christians, largely throughout the empire with regards to like church buildings and such. But Constantinople itself, when he walked the path of the walls, which everyone was like, that's insane. Nobody's ever going to... there's never going to be enough people for that. He establishes all sorts of rules for Constantinople that are unique throughout the kingdom, which is nobody pays taxes that lives inside these walls. Free food, free beer, free wine. Like, I mean, it was kind of nuts. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And actually, before before about the year 360, it had already filled the entirety of the most ridiculous size that the city already was, and they had to expand the walls. So it was insane, some of the stuff he was doing. And nobody had ever done this before. The idea of doing tax exemption, it's like, why would we do that? That's just less money. And why would we tolerate everyone? That's just less certainty and less control, right? We've always had a singular religion that we wanted to support and we wanted to enforce, and he's going, nah, no. Let's just let it slide. Now, he obviously favors Christianity, but he also, as emperor, holds all sorts of titles and responsibilities as priests to the other gods, which he fulfills his responsibilities there. How much does he see that as a personal religious thing? How much does he see that as a, I got to do it because it's my job thing? No one will ever know. And so the frustration and arguments continue. And the real question is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? It's a thing. And it's a frustrating thing at that, because it's nearly impossible to put it in such categories. To complicate things more, the other co-emperor with him was his brother-in-law, and also his main rival, Licinius. Both of them were seeking to bring the control away from this concept of the failed tetrarchy, because that just didn't work. That worked for one generation only, and that just led to more battles and more frustrations, and one guy is going to have to hold off all the Germanic tribes while the other one gets to grow everything on the French Riviera. I mean, let's be honest, that's not really fair. Nothing about joint rulership is. And so both of them have the goal to bring it under a singular rule. So Licinius is intending to, everyone knows that they're not going to rule together forever. Licinius is intending to assassinate Constantine. Constantine is just biding his time while rumors of how he took over Rome in a day spread throughout the empire. And it takes time for that, obviously. That's not like instantaneous. So they declared a truce. Now, focus on this time. We just discussed the Edict of Milan that both of them signed in 313. It's not until 322. So for 9 years, they actually held off towards one another. For 9 years, they were able to hold this off, but there was tension that continued to break off between them towards full control of the entire place. One of the realities is the effect of what Constantine was doing is, notice when you go to history, nobody thinks of Licinius as one of the signatories on the Edict of Milan. Nobody did then either. They just knew that he had to agree with that, otherwise Constantine would bulldoze his place as well. And so his status, as far as for Christianity was concerned, really hadn't gone clarified personally. He was just biding his time. And see, that's the thing, is everyone knew it was because of Constantine. And everyone has in their blood this idea that there's a singular emperor, right? The Tetrarchy only lasted for about 15 years, so it's not like nobody's ever experienced a singular emperor. It's been a singular emperor since Julius Caesar, right? I mean, so it's been nearly 400 years of that. It's really hard to get that out of everyone. It doesn't mean that Licinius hated Christians or was persecuting them. He wasn't. He was a signatory to the Edict of Milan. But the reality is, the more good stuff that happened with Constantine, the more Christians started writing glowing reviews of him. And the more glowing reviews means that, well, when there's two people here, which are we going to hate? We got to hate someone. And this is part of that growing pain in the church. We've always tried to see that somebody was against us. We do it today. Somewhere somebody is against us. They're trying to get us. They're trying to put us in a corner, whatever the case may be. And if you're going to choose between the guy who's putting crosses on his flags and the guy who hasn't really clarified his beliefs towards Christianity, on the other hand, the guy who's claiming to be a Christian and the guy who is decidedly not claiming to be a Christian, who's the enemy? Yeah, it's not that hard, is it? And being in that situation, it makes it much more difficult to understand how it lasted even that long. There were some who were trying to write for Licinius and sell his story to Christians who are now becoming a much more influential, over this decade, a much more influential section of the society. When Licinius finally gained his full victory over Maximinus Daya over in the west, or excuse me, in the east, they retold a whole story about his that sounds a whole lot like the Milvian Bridge issue, including a vision from heaven and all this kind of stuff, because trying to gather together his crumbling political sphere by essentially saying he had the exact same situation that Constantine had. Unfortunately, the ground was seeded. There was nothing to do, because now Christians throughout the empire were talking about Constantine as, quote, the emperor whom God loved. Now, does that remind you of anyone? What kind of stories in the Bible might that call up to your mind?
David.
Exactly. And a lot of comparisons were made. You know, and if you're talking about something, and again, you've got the issue with David, is his son tried to come and steal the empire away. Well, the promises were through David, right? What do you have with Constantine and Licinius? Licinius was his brother-in-law. You have these comparisons that exist, and if you're getting this idea that this is the emperor whom God loves, then it's wrong for me to support Licinius. Add that to the pagan mysticism of the rest of the people in the armies not wanting to stand up against this undefeatable sign on these shields of Constantine's army, what's going to happen? And Constantine knows this. And he just, if there's anything that I can say that's really good about him, he is patient and calculating, and he just lets it go. And then when the time's right, boom, hits it. And in 322... Constantine invaded Licinius' territories. Licinius was having a hard go of it already because he was starting to hold people accountable for praying for Constantine, which there was a lot of people that were starting to do so that were even in his ranks. He counted this as high treason. What does that start to remind everybody of? The days before the Edict of Milan, the days before the Edict of Tolerance, it's starting to remind us of Galerius. We all remember what happened to him, right? God gave him a wasting disease until he repented, and then God killed him 5 days later. We don't want to follow this guy. So the more Licinius spins his wheels, the worse and worse and worse it gets. To make matters even worse, Constantine doesn't even send a full-sized army to destroy him. Doesn't have to. Most people are so demoralized at the point in Licinius' army that, although quite a bloody battle at that, Constantine still wins. Perspective and perception is so important when it comes to the battlefield, and that was one thing that Constantine knew better than anyone. And it did not take long. Constantine became the sole master of the empire, bringing together both East and West, and putting an end to the civil wars near permanently, something that the Tetrarchy could not do. He finally brought it back onto a singular emperor. And then just to make sure that his empire would continue on, his kids were Constantine II, Constantius, and Constance. Just wanted to make sure, in case you were all not aware, these are going to be my descendants. They're going to be sitting on my throne. This is how it's going to go. Okay, so Maxentius was taken out by Constantine in Rome, and that was gone. Licinius had finally gotten over Maximinian Daya in the east. It was not a huge squabble. It was just kind of one of these things that faded away. Plus, the constant pressure from Persia at this point was really pinching over there. And so it wasn't that complicated of an ordeal, but it was something Licinius was able to bring under his control before all this, but too little too late. And that's kind of one of the realities of it.
And what finally happens to
Say again?
What finally happens to Licinius?
Licinius, that's a good question. I don't remember what happens to Licinius. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Constantine, I forgot about this. Constantine let him live, and then he got murdered after the... I don't mean to laugh at that. He was... It's just, unfortunately, when you rule an empire like that and become one of the most hated rulers that there is, that people in your own army are cheering on and praying for the guy on the other side, you need to go into exile somewhere really fast. That kind of stuff just doesn't last long. I had forgotten about that. Yeah, thank you. Good question. We want solidity now. When there's one emperor in place, we need to stop any concept that we're going to have another civil war. I mean, we had spent over 100 years working on civil war after civil war after civil war. Done. We're going to establish it not on the old religions, because that has not led us anywhere good. Plus, as we're much more learned now, we understand that even some of the greatest thought that came out of Greece, which Rome had great affinity for, was that there really was a supreme being that we should all serve. Now, if you remember appropriately, many of those who had been serving had been fans of the Unconquered Sun, S-U-N, and this is this concept of an ultimate god even above the Roman gods. Well, what does Constantine do but go, I know a way to bring everything together? The Christian God is that. Maybe another perspective of that. And you'll see that Constantine will in one breath support the Unconquered Sun, one breath support the God of the Christians. If we can reconstruct anything about Constantine's belief system, he was not just being political about this. If you want my opinion on it, which since you're here, I'm assuming, I hope, a little bit. My opinion is he truly believed that the God of the Christians was powerful. He truly believed that when he put these things on his shields, when he put them on his standards, that they carried with it a certain ability. Kind of like you see the Ark of the Covenant being used by the Philistines, right? That it had this magical property to it. You're looking at the ways that Jesus walked. You're looking at the Christians and how they continued even through persecution. There's something unique about this God. I'm going to use him as best as I can to bring the empire together. Because that's really what gods are for in Roman culture. You need to bring them to bring completeness and stability to the empire. We need to do that. If he's going to be master of the empire, we need clarity, we need predictability, we need solidity. One of the things that he chooses to do is to leave behind not only the gods of Rome, at least as far as their primacy is concerned, but leave behind Rome. He's going to make a new capital. And he's going to do it without the approval of the Senate. I don't care. You guys haven't managed this well at all. And are you going to stand against me? Really? Really? What happens to people who stand against me? Come on. It's not that hard. We're going to make a more fantastic thing. And here's the thing. Capitals belong in the middle of your country. They always do. If we had maintained just the 13 colonies, Washington, D.C. would be square in the center on purpose. We kind of didn't realize how far California was away. Now we can't quite realize how far their thinking is away, but that's okay. And so now all of a sudden we've got our capital sits bizarrely and weird on the East Coast. Which in reality, probably our capital should be moved to about St. Louis. At least historically speaking, that's where the capital is. It's in the center. The Roman Empire, the center used to be Rome. When it was just Italy, it was in the center. When it was spread out along the southern side of Europe as well as the northern of Africa, guess what? Still the center. It worked well. It worked pretty well at all, actually, and it was the city of Seven Hills. Everyone loved it. It was a great place. But now that we brought together East and West, and this is going to continue in perpetuity, we need a capital. We need it in the center where we can actually be equidistant from both sides. There's a part of an equality to this. And so what better place to choose than this little tiny place called Byzantium, right on the Bosphorus of the Black Sea, where the Black Sea meets the Mediterranean, this little isthmus that connects the east side to the west side of the empire. That's where Constantinople is placed. Constantinople. Yes, it wasn't just happenstance that he named it after himself. So he goes to this place, and he just walks. And he has all these surveyors. Follow me along. This is where the city walls are going to go. They say, how far are you going to walk? And he quotes, as far as the one who walks ahead of me. These theological expressions of everything that we're doing is God is leading this. It's going to happen because he's bringing it about. This is going to be a unique place unlike any other place. Now, the reality was Constantinople was a unique place unlike any other place. One of the interesting things about how Christians and even the pagan priests that were present at the setting out of Constantinople is, and this is kind of funny how Constantine will do this, we'll look at that and he'll say, you know, as far as the one who walks ahead of me, that's how far I'm. There's this like divine intervention on the size of Constantinople. Well, for Christians that are there, they're interpreting as, wow, God's leading him to build this new capital city. Well, what are the priests saying? Well, one of the gods is leading him. And this is one of these ways that every single time he talks to somebody, like the whole, you can't nail him down on what he actually is saying or what he's believing on these things, what makes him so very difficult.
But he can't lose.
He can't lose. And that's the story of Constantine. Unfortunately, he dies before his time in 337, but we'll get to that. Yes.
Which was closer to Rome.
Distance-wise, I mean, if you include Gaul and even Spain and stuff like that, it should have been a little bit closer that way. But where they were setting was the intersection of both shipping lane traffic and land-dwelling connections between Asia and all of Europe. I mean, it is. You just look it up on a map sometime and realize you're either going through Russia or on the ocean, or through Constantinople. And if you are a ship, if you're delivering to anywhere in the Black Sea, you're passing through their harbor. It is a remarkably unique place, awesome place, much better than Rome, much better than Athens. I mean, better than everything, honestly. It was a very intelligent decision to put that there. Defendable, clarifying, and that's why it stood for so long and still is there to this day. Now, it stood so long it finally fell to, does anyone know? What does Constantinople, when it fell in the 15th century, who took it over and what is it known as today?
Istanbul.
Istanbul, right. Fell to the Islamics. Was that? Maybe not quite yet, but did they? I'm not as up on the fall of Constantinople. I know it was extremely important, but... Really? Okay, when you say guns, I'm thinking...
No.
Okay. Because I know some of the first handheld things were sort of around. So you're talking cannons. Oh, yeah. Cannons will... Yeah. Unfortunately, that's kind of the thing is when you get so bound into something like that, you kind of depend that, well, these walls have never fallen, so who cares if new technology comes around? That's usually a bad sign. It had worked very well. Unfortunately, flying steel is completely different than people throwing fireballs. Okay, Constantinople, unique place, cool place, very strange place. There's a lot of unique things about it. One of the things that Constantine wants to do is this is going to be the most fantastic city in the world. Jerome, about 100 years later, actually writes that Constantinople was clothed in the rest of the empire's nakedness. The amount of things that they brought in from other cities, wealth, everything into Constantinople. I mean, you are making a capital city from scratch in a field. You're going to take everything from everywhere. One of the things he takes is a statue of Apollo. Because, you know, Christians aren't going to approve of Apollo, he says, don't worry about it. He cuts the head off and puts his own head on it. And he says, well, wait a second, that's not the tallest statue in the world. We need the highest. And so he goes down to Alexandria, which belongs to them now, takes one of their largest pedestals, columns, has it shipped all the way up there, and he goes, now, put it on top of that. Still not tall enough. He builds a much bigger pedestal, put the column on to put him now with the body of Apollo, which according to other historical sources, he didn't really look like Apollo, who was this like chiseled guy, you know, pretty awesome. But there his head goes on top of it anyhow. And that's just, that kind of gives you kind of the feel of what Constantinople is like. It's going to be the rest of the empire, but all here and all about me, including the name. And there was a lot of things that he did there. The Hippodrome, the public bath, certainly worth looking up and reading if this kind of stuff intrigues you at all. There was a basilica, the Basilica of St. Irene, pretty fantastic building. These types of things will start defining church buildings going forward. It's one of the things that makes this so unique is now Christians can actually own stuff together. And now we can start going, oh, that's interesting. So instead of just someone's old house that we just kind of like knock a wall down and build a tent outside so we can fit everyone, now we can sit down and go, well, what does a church building look like? Well, a place that we all gather together, a place specifically made for all of us to come together. What would that look like now? And those questions are bigger questions that get answered. And honestly, the people that knew how to build things knew how to build stuff in the Roman way. And that's what continues to define a lot of this stuff. Some of the noble families that lived in Rome that Constantine wanted the support of and offered their support, he says, you like your home? No worries. We'll take perfect measurements. I'll build you replicas. I mean, imagine all the money and all the laborers and all the work that you could possibly imagine. If you're offering this kind of stuff, and it's like, well, we've lived in old, stuffy Rome for so long. And honestly, Constantinople is in a bit of a better place with better farms. They have better year-round climate. Still right on the ocean. I mean, let's be honest. It's better than Rome. And, oh, wait, we don't have to pay taxes? You give us free food and beer and wine? When's the next ship? And you're going to build me my house because that's the last thing holding me there? Suffice it to say, Constantine knew how to delight his friends and frighten his enemies. And this made for a very unique situation in Constantinople specifically. People that came to live there not only got exemptions from taxes, but also of military service. Even their kids. What holds you back from moving now? The answer is absolutely nothing, at least not for those who are wealthy and those who were well-equipped to bring good stuff to the city. There's one thing about nobles throughout history that seems pretty unique. If you're going to tell me that somebody else is going to fight our wars and we don't have to, or we can buy our way out of that or buy our way into the clergy or whatever, there's going to be buyers. Happens all the time. Okay. One of the unique things about Constantine, as far as his claim to Christianity, is relationship with theology. Christians at the time refused to baptize him. Or he refused to get baptized. We're not entirely certain which it was. What we do know is that Christians took full advantage of this all over the place. He's not in the church, so we don't have to defend his actions when he does wrong things. He's a friend of the church. While we can call him the emperor whom God loves, that doesn't mean that he's a Christian. I mean, let's be honest. But that does mean that while we can support him and all this great and good stuff that he's doing for the church, we also don't have to defend him. And the reality is it made for a real comfortable situation for theologians in the church. Real comfortable. They don't have to correct Constantine because Constantine's never going to submit to their correction. So it's not like he's attending service and like the pastor has to correct him because that's his job. Hey, you went out and just murdered 10,000 people this week. I think you belong in here and have some penance to do. Constantine's never going to be submitting himself to somebody like that, but he will hire theologians to his court. He will have specific people in his entourage, some that I have already expressed, people like Lactantius, who actually tutored his son Crispus, Constantine's son Crispus. But then there's also someone really important. If you want a new name to remember tonight from church history, it's Hosius. H-O-S-I-U-S. He's the Bishop of Cordoba. And he joins in to a lot of what Constantine is doing, kind of a confidant, if you will. He's the Bishop of Cordoba, which is an interesting thing. If you recall in Roman history, one of the ways that Julius Caesar expressed his right to rule was to call himself the Pater Pateris, the father of fathers, right? As the father is in control of the house, I'm in charge of the fathers. One of the things that Constantine does is call himself the Bishop of Bishops, which is an interesting title to take on to himself. Something that certainly doesn't fit well with Christians. That's a real tough sell, but the reality is it's so easy living under his rule, and we're a lot wealthier, and everything's comfortable, and people aren't killing us. And he's sending the barbarians to the games rather than Christians, and do we really want to go backwards in that? Ooh. Tough calls. Because it's not like the Roman culture changed. They still had the games, they still had the beasts, they still had the Colosseums. And so this is leading to this difficult relationship that some of these theologians and bishops have with Constantine. We're certainly not going to baptize the guy. It's not like we can catechize him. And other than that, it's not like we can actually depend on him to live a holy Christian life. The state officials' positions in the Roman Empire had nothing to do with the holiness of the Christian life. And even those who, you know, with wide-eyed, glowing, you know, recommendations of how great Constantine is, are not going to go that far to say that he somehow is a Christian. And so they're going to like create this kind of unique, off to the side, like appendage of the church for Constantine himself, which makes it very strange, but certainly informs a lot of the ways that Christians have tried to interact with rulers who are friendly to them throughout history. You know, there's some people who try to claim, oh, you know, Christians and this and that, but there's always been this, if we're going to maintain a certain faithfulness to the gospel, we have to be realistic about this, and so we have the kind of this special place for rulers who are friendly to the church. That does not serve us well through history, by the way, at all, ever. It's something that, while it doesn't intentionally come in and fold on certain important issues, it will split our loyalties. And this is something that the church has to learn and it has to grow into. And it's something that Constantine is the first ruler that brings them to this point, to try to realize, you know, everything's going well here. And some people weren't quite grasping the reality. He's going to die someday. What then? You're establishing court theologian positions, establishing relationships to the emperor, whoever will sit on that throne next, that you will have this position with. What if they're not a Christian, the next one? And so you can see some of these theologians, they're like catechizing his sons, they're trying to stem this off, because they start getting this idea, wait a second, this is nice today, but what tomorrow? Constantine has his own plans. He seemed a real sincere man with regards to his appreciation of Christianity. There's nothing that I've ever read that would lead me to think that he was lying about all of this. But his understanding and grasp of the Christian faith, because he doesn't actually, you know, get catechized or, you know, go to church or anything, is really tenuous at best. And advantageous, honestly, is probably the best way to say it. The reality is that he ends up... I'll actually read this little section that Justo Gonzalez writes about him at his death. There was something that was kind of unique. In spite of all of these things, this is where I'm quoting him, almost to his dying day, Constantine continued functioning as the high priest of paganism, as was one of the requirements of the emperor. After his death, the three sons who succeeded him did not oppose the Senate's move to have him declared a god. This is an interesting thing. Watch this little clip here. So the Senate declares him a god after he dies. Thus, the ironic anomaly occurred that Constantine, who had done so much to the detriment of paganism, after his death became one of the pagan gods, and to compound the irony, the Eastern Church had already considered him a saint, thus resulting in a saint who is also a pagan god. It's a very interesting, if nothing else encapsulates the what in the heck do we do with a Christian on the throne, that does. Because the reality is, emperors, up until like the generation before that, declared themselves gods while they were alive. Constantine didn't do it, and so the Senate did it posthumously. Something that Constantine would have been in favor of. Yeah, he would have been. If nothing else, the statue with his head on top of Apollos, probably is gonna, or of Apollo rather, is probably going to do that. He was baptized on his deathbed. You can start seeing some of the concepts of last rites. We'll come into that later on. One of the things that happens during his reign. Okay, we're going to get to the Arian controversy and the Council of Nicaea. I want to stop here at the halfway point. Are there any musings or wonderments here at this point before we go into one of the cooler stories?
The basilica still stands, even though when the Moors took over Istanbul, they thought it was such an unbelievable, at least that's my understanding, it was such an unbelievable building that they preserved.
Yeah.
They put their Muslim signs on things.
The Hagia Sophia.
Normally, they would go in and anything of any religion, they would just...
Oh, yeah. They repurposed that building. Yep. It is interesting because it still stands to this day, and it's you've seen it, haven't you? Oh man, I'd love to see that at some point. Remarkable thing because it's one of these things that the enduring Roman architecture is. It was built not just to last. I mean, they just last. That's the way of it. Roman concrete was one of the most fantastic inventions in the ancient world that nobody talks about really. It outlasts our concrete by like 20 times over. Our concrete's terrible. We still are trying to figure out how they made concrete that good. If you ever go to some of these places, you'll see that where they mortared in the rocks or the bricks that they have, the bricks have all worn away, and then you'll get the mortar just sticks out from it. Because what they were using, they had some like crushed shell calcite stuff. The problem is that concrete, the chemical properties of it change when it cures, and it's kind of hard to turn the clock back. But it's really interesting stuff. The way they built these things, this is why churches, when they started going, you know what, we want to establish a church for centuries, we start to build in the Romanesque way. Because these things last. And if we're going to invest all this money, then we want it to last for years and years and years. And cathedrals are a whole other thing. But yeah.
So I'm trying to get a sense of the, quote, man in the street view of Constantine at this point. If I'm
confused,
I think, you know, okay, that's fine. I can be a Christian and he's sovereign. I'm good with that. If I'm a pagan, I can be a pagan and he's not against that. So, like, live and let live kind of thing.
So the perspective of people. So, again, it would completely depend on where you are. The perspective of people that are living in Constantinople, okay, they have a real close understanding of who he is. Anywhere else in the empire is just going to look at their lives. Am I better off than I was yesterday? Yep. I mean, that really is the extent. There's no Twitter, there's no Facebook, there's none of this. There's no newspapers. They don't care what he does as long as they don't have to get conscripted in bizarro wars, get taken from their homes, and everything's fine. Everything's at peace. Rome owned the world.
And the taxes weren't crushing.
Constantine, more than just about any other emperor, knew this exact little line, and he had like this instinct for it, to where he could tax people this much they'd revolt, this much they're fine with you. And he would always stay on that side of the line. And he knew how to ride it, and he knew how to do it, and maintain this. And honestly, he would have gone down as one of the most fantastic emperors in history if he didn't die so early on. Remarkable set of instincts that he had. Kind of strange, actually, and bizarre. Which has led to all sorts of theories throughout history as to, you know, God's blessing on and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, of course. So, I'm sorry, you have to have better tax codes to be a Christian, I think, right? I mean, that's what makes you a Christian, is right? Your fiscal policy? I think that's what it is. All right. During all of this, The controversies and confusions over theology continue. Not everyone who's a Christian is fully grasping or fully agrees with how theology had been expressed. There's some issues that arise in the church, and of all places, one of the great places that's going to arise is the most learned place in the church, Alexandria, Egypt. Believe it or not, the bishop there is named Alexander. So we have this wonderful guy named Alexander of Alexandria, which is the biggest mouthful ever. And he is putting forth a concept about things that really was just a discussion in Alexandria with regards to some of the more intricate things about the person of Jesus. He's such an interesting character, and we've never seen anyone like him. Now, you and I benefit from centuries and centuries of thought that we stand on when we're talking about the person of Christ. But nobody is sitting there going, hey, do you want to take a class on the Trinity? Nobody's doing this yet. Now, it doesn't mean they don't have a concept of the Trinity, right? I mean, the baptismal formula is right there at the end of Matthew, right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's the definitions of these things that are so tough. And the reality is, in Alexandria, Egypt, they speak Greek. What do they speak in the West? Latin. Be prepared for that to become a huge problem in the church with regards to talking about theological things. When you're starting to talk about minutiae, you start to divide over words. When you're dealing with two different languages, dividing over words, semantics becomes a massive problem. Greek and Latin do not have the same roots. They don't have the same meanings. They don't have the semantic ranges, especially when you're starting to talk about philosophical concepts. Latin was not built out of philosophical concepts. Greek was. Greek was what the New Testament was written in. It makes the East see themselves as more attentive to what's in Scripture. In the Latin, they have to translate everything. And the reality is, there is no Latin translation of Scripture yet. Nobody's translating Scripture at this point, like in massive movements, until like 10 years later. So, one of the things that comes up in Alexandria, the nature of Jesus. More than that, the nature of the Son himself. Before the incarnation, before creation, before everything. And here's the thing, if you go into a lot of churches and you talk about who is Jesus before Bethlehem, I would be willing to bet that a good 40%, 50% of everyone would, the next thing out of their mouth would be a big old pile of heresy. And they would have no concept of it whatsoever. Like he was a completely different person, or he was just subordinate, hadn't earned his way to this yet, or maybe he had or something, I don't know, he was like an angel. I mean, so many different things bump around in people's minds that they just never really wrestle with. And the reality is, as weird as the Arian controversy was, the reality is they were much more accurate, even in their heresy, than the vast majority of people in churches today. They had no problems with the divinity of Christ. No problems with the pre-incarnate Christ being fully divine. None. They had him as creator of the whole world, heavens and earth, no problem. They disagreed on one thing. He was the first thing that the Father made, and then through him, everything else was made. Can you see this in Scripture? If you're dealing with a different language than your natural language, and nobody's ever really written on this before. These are intricate theological things, but they're really, really important. They really are. And so now we're starting to deal with something that starts off as kind of a conversation after a Sunday morning between a bishop and his deacon. And it was a little local thing in Alexandria. If ever's going to come up anywhere, it's going to be Alexandria. It's the most learned Christian place in the world. And this grows into a full-blown controversy right at the time that Constantine, long live Constantine, blessing be upon him, is on the throne. We have a Christian emperor. And we got this controversy arising. We got this kind of stuff going up. And a lot of the Christians in the East are calling for, we need some help to try to deal with this. A lot of the discussions come up. What are we going to do? The church, before this, in order to deal with controversies, did so with the power of their arguments and holy living. It doesn't mean that they didn't meet together for local councils. They certainly did, all over the place, all over the place. They would meet together, they'd have discussions, but all of them were local. Why? Because, well, first of all, the people in the West don't speak the same language as the people in the East. And besides that, what authority does that have over here anyway? We can just discuss it here. We'll work it out between all our bishops and we'll deal with it. Despite what the Catholic Church claims about the primacy of Rome, we'll get into that in a little bit. A local thing spreads throughout the Eastern Empire. What's that going to do to the rulership and the stability of the empire? If we're going to have separations over theology that you guys are not going to agree on no matter what, we have got to keep peace in this empire. So what does Constantine do? Notice the timeline. He takes over the empire in 322, immediately starts working on Constantinople. The Council of Nicaea is called in 325. 3 years. That means we want to solve all of these things, and this is one of the more important ones. The council at Nicaea is called. Okay. So it's not like they sent out little pamphlets and they're just like, by the way, we're going to discuss Arius and all his stupidity. Just come here and we'll talk about it or something like this. No. There wasn't a set agenda. It's bishops. 1,800 of them were invited. Bishops, all bishops in the church everywhere, are invited on the emperor's dime to travel to Nicaea to come and establish what is Christianity. To establish how do we interact with certain things? How do we deal with controversies? Arian controversy might be coming up, who knows, for a conversation. What is it that you do? What are the practices? These types of things will come up. They didn't have a set itinerary, this is what we're going to discuss, here's the breakoff groups or anything like that. But there was a number of things that were coming up in the church, specifically dealing with the lives of unfaithful bishops. How do we remove them from office? How do we ordain new ones? And there was disparate practices throughout the empire, and Constantine didn't really like that so much. Let's come together, all of you guys decide what it is. And let's just have unity throughout the whole empire. That would be helpful to the country. That'd be helpful to all of you. Right?
Absolutely.
Right. So you're going to pay for all of this? Right. Sounds good. Now, for whatever reason, a number of them could not come. A large number of them could not come and didn't come. Doesn't mean that they were against this or anything like that. We don't really fully know. But what we do know is there was over 300 bishops all throughout all the provinces. The list is extensive. You have everyone, Libya, Alexandria, of course, Jerusalem, Antioch, Rome, Trier, everywhere. They're all coming to Nicaea, which is conveniently within, a horse ride from Constantinople. All coming there to try to figure out what to do. Sounds great. Right? So, yes and no. Speculating about how a lot of these that didn't go felt about this is really difficult. Certainly there were some who thought it absolutely inappropriate that the emperor would preside over this. Certainly there were some of those, and some of those were quite loud about their disagreement with that. Some just couldn't. Others had no interest, especially in the West. Nobody cares about Arius. You know why? Because the Arian controversy ain't happening in my valley. This is somebody else's fight. It's not mine. And so, and they've never done this before. The church has never gathered together for a full ecumenical council. That's just never happened. The closest thing to it was the council in Jerusalem, and that, the only reason that that carried that kind of weight was they were apostles. I mean, let's be honest. That's completely unique. We've never really done that again. We had other meetings that were local, that were dealing with local issues. But the worldview of people was not, I'm going to go help solve the emperor's issues. The worldview was, it's not bothering me. What do I care? I would imagine that about 1,000 of them would have had about that idea to it. I don't really care enough to travel 1,500 miles on horseback or on foot, even if someone else is paying for it, to go and talk about something. I'm just going to be one vote among hundreds and hundreds. Or who? What do I care?
Gone for weeks, if not months.
Oh, months. Months.
And if you think about Jerusalem, I assume they had many churches and they had many bishops, so maybe they decided, well, you go as our emissary and we'll listen to you as the voice of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem church, rather than be completely vacated of all of our teachers.
Right. So this happens specifically for the bishop in Rome, who does not go. He sends some people in his stead. He's just too advanced in age. By the time you become a bishop, you're not 25, you know, wearing hipster jeans, right? So you're usually well advanced. You're not going to be traveling 1,000 miles. It's just not happening. So you do have a lot of more lower level bishops going, if you will. They're not going to be like the heads of huge cities, right? Which Rome still was a massive influence and a massive city in its own right, even though it wasn't the capital of the empire anymore. But that had only been like 5 years beforehand. So it's an interesting thing that comes up. We're not going to discuss a lot about the Arian controversy, only to say that Arianism was essentially saying that Jesus was the first created being, and then he created everything else. Some people saw it as minutiae of theology. Does that really affect our Christian life? But then, of course, theologians, we like to pursue the ramifications of things. If he's not fully God, like on the creature-creator distinction thing, then could he actually have suffered once for all, or could he have only suffered once for one? So, atonement is born out of this and everything else, right? So, yeah. But before the incarnation, everyone agreed on the preexistence of the Word, the Logos, the Son. Nobody was calling that into question. I'm not saying that the Arians were like misunderstood. I'm just saying they had better theology than most Christians today. And we need to do better. The reality of some of the things that were going on there really had to do with trying to solve specific issues. And I wanted to read a couple of things because what came out of the Council of Nicaea was a series of canons, a series of statements about specific issues, and then a creed. Most of you know the Nicene Creed. That's not the original one. That's the one that comes out of the Chalcedonian definition over 100 years later. The original Nicene Creed specifically had a whole paragraph at the bottom condemning all the Arians and everything that they say. We're going to read some of that as well. But I wanted to go through a couple of canons because I want you to think about something with me for a second, right? As I've been teaching church history, you'll notice how little I've been talking about the primacy of Rome and the Bishop of Rome and the popes. Why haven't I been talking about them? I mean, if this was a Catholic, we would have started, Peter. What's the guy they claim right after that? Is it Livius or Lucius? I forget what his name is. Then Clement, Anacletus, and go all the way through this list of these bishops in Rome that are serving there as popes. Why haven't I been talking about this the whole time? Anyone got a guess? So they were called bishops of Rome, and they were that, just as there was bishops everywhere. The real issue is not the question of was there a bishop in Rome. There certainly was. The real question comes in, is the Bishop of Rome in charge of all the other bishops? Which is what Constantine calls himself, the Bishop of Bishops. Well, after Constantine kind of passes and the glory of the empire really settles in Constantinople, and within 100 years, the entire western side of this falls to the barbarian hordes, you get something else completely that happens in the governance of Rome with regards to the bishop's role in Rome during that period that we're going to talk about kind of at the close of the imperial church. But the Bishop of Rome, to say that he plays a role that like popes today play is nonsense. The reality is that, but that switch takes place in the 4th century, okay? And a lot of it has to do with the Roman Empire leaving Rome. A lot of it also has to do with Rome itself. And so I'm just going to take about 5 minutes here to kind of explain my worldview thinking about this, because it's a little bit frustrating sometimes to pick up another history book written kind of more from a Catholic perspective and going, you know, the whole story of this is not about, you know, the church being persecuted and working through scriptures and stuff like this. It's all about Clement and fixing Corinth, and it's all about this pope doing this or this pope doing that, most of which is theoretical. The reality of why I'm teaching this way is because what history has come down to us, the primacy of Rome, meaning Rome is more important than everywhere else in the entire empire, does not really come into the importance until Rome gets abandoned by Constantine. When Rome gets abandoned by Constantine, things change in the city of Rome in very weird ways. One of them is if Constantine is taking everything to Constantinople and that's becoming the new see of it, this is changing the empire completely, and all the ways of Rome and all of the architecture of Rome and all of the living here in Italy, all of this culture that we have, the local government has no concern with maintaining. The church does in Rome. And it's such a unique position that it's taken, and over the next several centuries really starts developing a view of itself that has primacy. In fact, so much so does this come across that letters that were sent from the Bishop of Rome during this time period, there's a really interesting answer back from Basil of Caesarea, who says, now this is an interesting letter I've received from you guys, thinking that somehow your say has meaning anything to us here. What? Why do you think you have that authority in a place that Christ has given us this authority? The church has one head. What are you doing? But the Western church, as it will soon become, speaks Latin. It's in the West that falls within 100 years of this. The East speaks Greek. It never falls. It becomes the Byzantine Empire. And it is so for over 1,000 more years, outlasting anything Rome ever had dreams of. And you have several main cities where there were very prominent bishops. Jerusalem, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople gets their own, and then later on places like Moscow and others. The Eastern Church has several collegial ruler sets, if you will. The West has one, Rome, right? And here's the kind of the reality that as we get into the Imperial Church, not only does the church that involves itself with Constantine and then all the embroiled controversies when we finally get an Arian that becomes an emperor and everything gets tossed up in a roll, all of these other things that happen in the 4th century, the church in Rome is having an identity crisis, big time, and trying to establish itself as we are the ancient church. And so the real issue does not exist over, well, is there a bishop of Rome? Oh, there absolutely is. There had been ever since the very beginning, just as there had been a bishop in Jerusalem and all these other places, right? You even have Irenaeus referring to him. Actually, he refers to him in very glowing terms. And it seems quite obvious that those things came down. But as far as for we are the only one that truly matters, that attitude only takes off after Rome gets abandoned by the empire. And so I want you to see, the reason why I'm bringing that up is because a couple of the canons in the Nicene canons make absolutely no sense if Rome is in charge of the world at this point. And this is something that you're not really gonna deal with much when you're trying to work through Catholic history, because the Council of Nicaea, first of all, the Bishop of Rome's not there. In fact, no Bishop of Rome ever presided over any ecumenical council. Ever. One, the most important thing about the Council of Nicaea is, well, this is primarily an Eastern issue, but you had bishops all from the West, and there were representatives of the Bishop of Rome there, but he's not presiding over this. And so this kind of really does come up with regards to what is the right way we deal with theology in the church? Who decides what's right? And by the way, we talk about the Nicene Creed. Some of us who grew up in more liturgical situations have quoted that. What gives that authority? Is it just because bishops from all over the Roman Empire came together and wrote it? Is that what gives it authority? Is it because it's ecumenical? Where does authority come from? This is going to become a huge issue for the rest of the history of the church, is when it comes to theology, when it comes to authoritative statements, where does the authority rest? Is it in creeds? Is it in councils? Is it in the scriptures? That's not as easy a thing to prove as you think. Or is it in our bishops? Or is it in the bishop? And it depends on where you live and how you interact with theology as to how you're going to answer that in the fourth century. So let's answer it here. Where does authority come from? Don't say the Bible. Don't say it. That's such an easy answer. How do you get there? Why does the Bible have that authority? The Holy Spirit. Who else does he indwell? Not just Scripture, right? The church. Now you have to get into the questions. What's the church? The Arians call themselves the true church. The Nestorians call themselves the true church. In fact, they do all sorts of missionary things out to China. Remarkable after this time. The church in the West calls themselves the true church. The church in the East calls themselves the ancient church. The Protestants call themselves the restoration of the true church. Where's the church? And all of a sudden, you're starting to talk about authority again and identity. We got to define the church. If we're going to define that the authority of the Holy Spirit rests in the church as well, then we need to define the limits of the church. Who's in and who's out? And who's got the authority to define that? It's not easy. Because the reality was, it was a lot easier when we were being persecuted. You know who the fake Christians were? Those who, when the lions were threatened, they gave up. Man alive, how empty would the pews be today? It was really easy to tell who the true Christians were. Now, people disagreed over whether being a lapsed person meant you weren't a Christian or not. What everyone agreed with is, you're at least called into doubt, my goodness gracious. And so you'll get people that are held in high esteem, the confessors. And we discussed this a little bit. When the Council of Nicaea is called together, you have people there that are missing limbs. You have people there that have burns. You have people there that have all the signs and marks of persecution throughout the empire. And guess who's going to be listened to more than everyone else? You guys got the coats back on, I see. It was either cold or can't hear, and I chose cold. Only 10 more minutes. So, confessors. So, a lot of these are at the Council of Nicaea. Guess what? Their opinion is really important. You know why? We have proof that they're Christians. Proof. It's sitting on them. If you've been chewed on by a lion and refused to recant, okay, I'm kind of going to listen to you. And it's not because I don't believe Scripture. It's because I actually trust that the Holy Spirit of God indwells his people. And you've conferred that you're one of his people. I want to listen to you. Even if you're wrong, I want to listen to you. And so the question of authority really comes up, and it does not go away, even to today. We still have this argument. We still have this argument. If you're Catholic, the authority rests in the church, period. It's not scripture. It's not anything else. It is the church, period. If you're Protestant, at least classically Protestant, it depends on which side of the Protestant. Okay, if you're classically Protestant and confessionally Protestant, it's the scriptures. It's the scriptures. That's where the authority comes from. And so it's incumbent upon us to interpret it well, and so we do all of our work. And we spend a lot of our time doing that. If you're in the Eastern Church, it's not that easy. They don't have a singular head of the church. They have multiple, and they're not interested in establishing theology and developing theology or in clarifying things. Their culture is much, much more comfortable with things that don't really make sense than the West is. And so they hold a lot of things that they're just like, huh, that's mysterious. Oh, well. Where in the West, we're like, mystery just means something to be solved. We have to debate it and argue it and kill people. In the East, not so much. And so, what's that?
And then split over it as well.
Yeah, and then we'll still split over it. Right, we'll split over it and then we'll dig up their bones and we'll burn them just to make sure everyone knows that they're crap. That's kind of how the West deals with stuff. In the East, not so much. They do have an authority structure, but it's much more collegiate. And the reality is that they're not really interested in developing or even defining things, because if you go to a bookstore, if you go to Amazon, if you're going to try to find a systematic theology of the Eastern Orthodox Church, I'll pay $1 billion for it. It doesn't exist. You know why? Their theology is their liturgy. That's it. And you go, how in the world can that be? I don't know. I'm not Eastern Orthodox. It's a mindset and a worldview that's intrinsic to culture and then frozen in the 8th century and doesn't move. It's very difficult. It's why when you go into an Eastern Orthodox church, you're stepping back 1,300 years into history. And you're just like, what just happened? The reality is that they're not looking to develop. They're not looking to change things. They're looking to preserve things. And so they'll see themselves as the ancient church. And so for them, authority is in the liturgy. You're not going to find them with praise bands, and it's just not going to happen, because you'll become a new thing. That would be like us taking the systematic theology and going, and you'll be like some of the people I go to seminary with, just throwing it in the garbage and making up stuff as you go along. So this really becomes kind of the next thing for the imperial church. How do we decide these things? And if we've got the emperor in the West that's trying to bring together East and West, which we already had our own. I mean, the East really likes Origen. He's crazy and castrated himself. We don't like that. And then in the West, we have Tertullian, but he became a Manichaean at the end of his life. What are we going to do about that? Everyone's got their skeletons in their closet, and everyone's kind of just going like, I don't really know how to do this. And at least Constantine is trying to bring us together into one room and say, how do we deal with something that we all know is wrong? Okay, we'd be foolish if we didn't take advantage of that. So they come together. And notice, by the way, a couple of the canons. If you want, it's interesting reading. It's not very long. The 20 canons of Nicaea, certainly worth working through, especially the first 10. But if you're a 10 in already, just go to 20. And there's certain things that with regards to, and by the way, so here's one of the things that certainly the Western bishops had much influence over. With the first canon is regarding those who have been castrated, believe it or not. And certain things, if this was something imposed on them or something they chose and what to do in that situation. A lot of it is just, how does the church interact with life, right? The second canon, for instance, is with regards to those who had been, who were advancing to the office of either elder or bishop. They can't be really young people, they should be older. Along the way, they've actually shown themselves to this. A lot of this is also with regards to what precautions should be taken place if they're, believe it or not, counseling young women. Issues then, issues today. It's always been rules in the church about not doing something stupid. And that was Canon 3. Canon 4. For instance, okay, this is an interesting one, right? I'll just read this one. It's only a paragraph. It is by all means proper that a bishop should be appointed by all the bishops in that province. But should this be difficult, either on account of the urgent necessity or because of distance, three at least should meet together, and the suffrages of the absent bishops also being given and communicated in writing, then the ordination should take place. But in every province, the ratification of what has been done should be left to the bishop that oversees it all. Not Rome, by the way, I'll simply point out, but the local province, the metropolitan bishop. Canon 5, all about excommunication. Guess what's not included? The bishop in Rome. Nobody cares. This is all taken care of on a local provincial basis. And all of these bishops came together. Hey, how do you excommunicate people? Oh, by the way, we should bring up that when I excommunicate someone, they can't go to your church. And everyone's like, that's a really good thing. Put that in there too. And the reality is that they come out. A lot of this is just basic stuff. You can't have young idiots in the bishoprics. I don't care what you do anywhere in the church. No. Just not having somebody in their 20s leading a bishop, which is a bishop, if you remember, overseeing of a city, connecting all the elders of all the churches together, so because they all met in different places, right? And so a necessary hierarchy, unfortunately, at some points in history. No counseling of young women by yourself. I mean, this is really basic stuff. This isn't Constantine coming together and going, hey, church, we're going to decide for what's in Scripture, for instance. It needs to be Genesis and Exodus, and I don't like the Maccabees. They're not going to be in there. They're not doing any of this. That's not what they even discussed at the Council of Nicaea. In fact, that doesn't even get listed until the next ones. And even there, it's not a discussion. It's just them going, oh, by the way, here's the Scriptures. Unfortunately, Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code, and several other people have just absolutely destroyed what people think the Council of Nicaea did.
It's still fun picture.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Great stuff. All right, Canon 6, really important, and I'll stop with this one. Really important stuff. Let the ancient customs in Egypt, Libya, North Africa, and Pentapolis prevail, that the bishop of Alexandria have jurisdiction in all of these, since the like is also customary for the bishop of Rome also. In other words, he has influence on those who live nearby. Just the same. Likewise, in Antioch and the other provinces, let the churches retain their privileges. And this is to be universally understood, that if any one be made bishop without the consent of the metropolitan, that is, the bishop over the larger sections, the great synod has declared that such a man ought not to be a bishop. If, however, two or three bishops shall from natural love of contradiction, I love that phrase, oppose the common suffrage of the rest, it being reasonable and in accordance with the ecclesiastical law, then let the choice of the majority prevail. If you don't realize the importance of that canon, basically it takes all of Rome's claims from the first 400 years and throws them in the garbage. It does. And the reality is... Say again?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Because it was just like, oh, by the way, and by specific name, wink, wink, Bishop of Rome is just like you, where you have control in your province, and Antioch, and Pentapolis, and Alexandria, and Jerusalem, and everywhere else. And oh, by the way, if you can't really come to it because there's a couple of hard-headed bishops that are just standing in the way because, what did he say? They have a natural love of contradiction, which is a new way I think I'm going to define myself when I fill out a bio. Oh, no, I put it on myself beforehand. I did it first. A natural love of contradiction. It's a remarkable little phrase. Anyway, if you've got two or three that are just holding up the consecration or the ordination of a bishop just because they love contradiction, just let the majority rule. Who cares? And it's just such a remarkable thing because, look, you've got 300, and the official count was 318 bishops. They each oversaw multiple churches. That's well over 1,000 churches that they have experience in. What is it we know? There's some hard-headed people. What do we do? What do you guys do? Here's what's worked. Great. Let's just make that what we do. And again, is...
Most of them are what we determine mundane, because that's what they spend the whole of their day.
Yes! Yes! It was mundane. Most of it was. Now, the creed that they put out from this wasn't mundane. It was clear theology. They were expressing it and saying, by the way, none of us throughout the entire empire support Arianism. We got it clarified to us. Now, the reality is, nobody of the Western bishops cared about that until the Arians came up and presented their case at the Council of Nicaea. And then they're all like, what now? You think, what now? Hang on a second. We didn't care about this, but now it's in our locality. What did you just say? Jesus is the first created thing? Oh, heck no. We're not doing this. And they settled it down there like that. So it's an interesting set of things. I would encourage you to read the rest of the 14 canons. Really mundane stuff, really normal stuff, really smart stuff. Does it settle the authority? What authority do these canons have? You're going to hear a lot when we come to the primacy of Rome about canon law. You're going to hear a lot about conciliarism. When a council is called, does it have more authority than the Pope, or does the Pope have more authority than the council? This will come up in the late Middle Age church. And that goes all the way to the 19th century, believe it or not, when the Pope finally decided, hey, actually, I have more authority than the councils. Yay. The 1800s was fun. But what do we do for all this history? Who has the authority and who has the way to make this? When they're coming together, they're not saying, boom, you have to do this, you have to do this, and this, and this, and all these canons, otherwise you're not a Christian. What? This is not even what they're talking about. What they're talking about is, here's how we do stuff. It's helpful. It's meant to be helpful. And it's also meant to go, hey, you two or three boneheaded bishops here that are just holding up the ordination of this otherwise qualified guy, when you got 10 other bishops that are going, they're fine, calm down. All of a sudden we have the weight of 318 other bishops that agree with us. It's just like, just don't be boneheaded about this and let it pass through. It was meant to smooth everything out and help. That's what Constantine wanted. That's what the bishops wanted. And honestly, for the church, in some places, it's what it needed. Now, do I agree with how it all went down? Nope. Do I agree with the idea that councils have a special authority? I don't. The only authority that a pastor or a bishop or a council or a pope or a creed or a canon, for that matter, it only bears the authority insofar as it comports to the authority of God. That is it. It is why Scripture is ultimate authority for us. Why? Because it's from His lips, unstained by the pen of man. It claims such. So it either is or it's not at all. You say, well, and who gets to interpret that rightly? It does, because it's the only thing that's that good. And so we have to teach the whole counsel of God. I'm pretty sure it says that in there somewhere. Where we actually have to devote ourselves to the whole of it and not pick and choose and throw away certain parts and not pay attention to certain parts. We really need to devote ourselves to the whole of it. This becomes a defining issue in the second millennium of the church, and it does lead to the Protestant Reformation, because all of a sudden people had scriptures in their hands and go like, the church in here looks nothing like the church I've known all of my life. What am I supposed to do with that? There's a lot of stuff that leads to that, yes. Most of it... Okay, so in the Western church, sacerdotalism was one of the biggest, the sacramental system, the very teaching of grace itself. The inability of people, or the illegality of maintaining scriptures in your own language, for instance, held back people at crazy. The scriptures are meant to be read in vulgar tongues. They're meant to be read in your heart language. Translating constantly from another language does not do. And Jesus himself used translations for that exact purpose to people who knew Greek and not Hebrew, and he spoke to them from the Septuagint, the Greek translation. Because it's translatable, and that's where it does its work, is fully translated and communicated to people. It becomes after, so in the West, they end up translating, Jerome does, officially, meaning supported by the, you know, powers that be, officially translating the Old and New Testament to Latin. And he does that from the Hebrew, and he does that from the Greek, and he establishes it in Latin. And does anyone know what it's called? The Latin Vulgate? It comes from the term vulgar. It was the language they spoke. And so all of a sudden, we have this translation in our own language. Guess what? After Rome falls, nobody's speaking Latin anymore. Now we've got these crazy Franks in here and these Visigoths and these Germanic tribes. They speak this horrific language. Like, we'll just maintain Latin for ourselves. And it becomes a church language. And then that's what we're going to do the Mass in. We certainly can't do it in vulgar tongues because we've established for hundreds and hundreds of years what it is. And that's holding us together, our tradition. And all of a sudden, nobody knows Latin. And now it's becoming, if you get to the 10th and 11th century, it's illegal to translate into anything else. But you're starting to get some of these learned men, people like John Wycliffe, going, I know the value that the scriptures are if it's in our own tongue. And so in little instances throughout this 12th, 13th, 14th centuries of people trying to translate it, it getting burned, them getting burned, persecuted, inquisitions, wars, multiple papacies, everything. Then the printing press comes out. Boom. Now, any old little monk can translate something into German and have it printed, and the Pope doesn't approve of it, and all of a sudden the people can read the scriptures themselves in a language that they heard their parents speaking since they were children. That made all the difference. And I would rather take all of the denomination splits and schisms that are of today than people that belong to the Lord not knowing his word. Yep, I'd take all the division in the church today. Because now we can actually look to the authority of God, direct, and deal with stuff. And that will get messy. The church is always messy. There's no other way to say it. Everywhere, all the time, constantly. There's no perfect church. The early church certainly wasn't. The imperial church wasn't. Medieval church, none of them were. And so, all of that having been said, the question of authority will continue to develop into an absolute monster in the imperial church. And the primacy of Rome is the West, and then trying to deal with the primacy of Rome in the East and their attitude, for lack of a better way to say it, just that pride that exudes from Rome. And then their idea that they have to maintain the memory of Rome that was after the fall of the Western Empire. It's going to be quite a trip. But I hope to help work through some of the issues of why some of the discussions that we have even in the church today maybe get cut off at the pass and we don't really understand why. So any questions or thoughts before we close out here at this point?
I'm kind of looking through.
Yeah, we're not done with it yet, but yes.
Okay. Because I always thought of it as, you know, it was called together to deal with Arians, but that really wasn't the focus of it.
Nope.
And from what I'm hearing you say about Constantine, I almost get the sense that it was, okay, in order to be stable and predictable, we're basically calling all of the people together to, and this may be overstating it, but essentially write a constitution of church. This is what this part means and how we get there and that. But then later as you talk, it sounds like it really wasn't that either.
Nope. And the effect of it wasn't, because it wasn't the last ecumenical council even of that century.
Sure.
It wasn't solving all problems at all times. It was saying, hey, what issues are you dealing with throughout the empire so that we can help smooth everything over? And they did.
Okay, so it may have had that kind of generic...
Yeah. Like I said, it didn't really have an itinerary at the beginning.
But the actions were more, this is the problem we're dealing with now.
Right, right. So, like, we had this issue where this young bishop was serving somewhere and he wasn't really fully trained so well and... You know, or this section of the empire that hasn't dealt with any persecution at all, they don't even catechize their people, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
so. Yes, because it brought stability. That's all he was looking to do. Yeah. Okay, that's all I think he was there to do. There's a lot of people with all sorts of other theories, but that's all I think he was there to do in full. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.